Good evening, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. Last night, we kicked back a little bit, toned down, took a look at what people were doing with the freedom that everybody's fighting for. Today's been a rough day all over the world, and it is a world problem. Canada lost another fine young man in Afghanistan, but obviously the Middle East crisis, the war between Israel, Hezbollah, and indeed Lebanon, is a war that involves all of us around the world. There were three flashpoints today. Israeli cabinet approved of a wider and broader invasion. Divisions are massing at the Lebanese border. Many people think it's a good idea that finally there are going to be boots on the ground and more stress on infantry than air power. We're going to get a first-hand report on that from Ron Ben-Ishai, who's the senior correspondent for Israel's largest daily, Yediot Ahronot. And he goes back and forth from the northern border every day. Second flashpoint is taking place in Geneva, where the Human Rights Council, that wonderful UN body of such august free countries as China and Cuba and Libya and Iran, are undertaking an investigation of possible war crimes. And that is just more of the same from that bunch of sanctimonious hypocrites. But we'll be talking to a fascinating young man named Hillel Neuer, who's a Montrealer, started his career as a lawyer in New York, and is the executive director of United Nations Watch, which was started by former U.S. Ambassador Morris Abram. And then we'll be going to San Francisco, Stanford University professor Victor Davis Hanson, and talking with him about what he feels is a global culture of appeasement. And he really sees the world today and the critical mass that we're heading to as a repeat of 1938, and we have many lessons to learn from that period. And, you know, Canadians generally are beginning to get it, despite Monday's rally for peace, in quotations, in Montreal. Quebec may really be left out in the cold as everybody begins to understand that this fight is a fight by all free nations. And it was put so well in today's Globe and Mail by Marcus G., who's the comment and op-ed editor. And he very succinctly put, an assertive Lebanon? A tough international force? Give me a break. The hard truth is this conflict grinds on because no one wants to take on Hezbollah, not the government of Lebanon, not the rest of the Arab world, and certainly not its sponsors in Syria and Iran. As usual, the dirty job is left to Israel. So we're going to be back right after this break, and we're going to take a tour of the world from Tel Aviv to Geneva to San Francisco and take a look at this burgeoning crisis right after this. Montreal and everybody listening on the World Wide Web, as I said in the intro, we're going to be talking about the world at war, and it really is the world at war. It's Israel. It's doing the heavy lifting, but that's a reality that that is true today. And three flashpoints. In Israel, the cabinet has approved an expanded incursion into Lebanon to wipe out Hezbollah. In Geneva, the Human Rights Council will be taking a look at possible violations of human rights, and that's almost an oxymoron when you say Human Rights Council of the United Nations. And then we'll be going to the Hoover Institute and talking to Professor Victor Davis Hanson on what he feels is a culture of appeasement in the West, and that it's time that we stood more closely with Israel. But first, let's get an update from what's going on with Ron Ben-Ishai, senior foreign correspondent of Yediot Ahronot, the largest daily in Israel. And Ron, welcome and thank you for staying up this late. I know it's about 1 o'clock. You go to the northern border and back regularly. What's the story on the ground today?
The story on the ground today is that the fighting in the area where the IDF has already taken from the Hezbollah along the border is heavy. Israel suffered about 12, maybe more, casualties, that is, dead soldiers. The bombardment by the Hezbollah of Israel's northern, populated areas, villages and towns, from Haifa to Afula, from Haifa to Metula, yes, is continuing. They launched today over 190 Katyushas so far against Israel, and the augmentation of the operation that is supposed to quell this rocket launching is about to start. That you spoke of further incursion into Lebanon. Actually, It is the operation continues in the same area, that is southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah has...
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me. I misspoke. I meant to say a stronger incursion on the ground. There's we hear reports there are five infantry divisions massing at the border. Is there an expectation that this job can be finished better now that there's been the green light for the infantry to go ahead and less reliance on air power?
There is a large exaggeration. Israel has deployed in this operation so far two divisions in this area, and there is another division that is going to be added into the fighting inside this area, which is called southern Lebanon, which is the area south
of the Litani River.
The Litani River, and between the Litani River and Israel border, it is an area of about 20 kilometers wide and 70 kilometers long.
Is there, though, an expectation that because there's going to be a greater ratio of boots on the ground, of soldiers to guerrilla fighters, to Hezbollah terrorists, that will be able to allow the IDF to get out these Hezbollah nests that are infiltrated in the civilian areas more surgically?
No, they have not infiltrated. They live there.
That's
Many of them simply live there. They have the Katyushas, the rockets, mainly the short-range rockets, in their cellars. They have the launchers on their pickups, and this is how they shoot. They are Iranian soldiers in the day, and the peasants, when the Israeli Air Force comes to look for them.
From your sources, Ron, was it a tough cabinet meeting today, a security cabinet meeting today that made this decision? Was it acrimonious? Were there recriminations, or is there a united government?
There was some verbal skirmishes, mainly between a ex-defense minister and the present defense minister. The ex-defense minister said we should have done it long ago, and that we should have done it differently from the way you suggest to do it. And the other minister said you were defense minister 5 years.
Why didn't you do it?
And allowed the Hezbollah to accumulate and rockets and dig in the area, and you have done nothing. But there was the decision was approved almost unanimously. There were three abstentions, but also by Shimon Peres, who believes that Israel should wait for the Security Council decision, etc. But there were not real debate about it.
Well, I don't know if you heard in my introduction, there was a major op-ed piece in Canada today out of the Globe and Mail, and Marcus G., who is the opinion editor, wrote just very sarcastically, an assertive Lebanon, a tough international force, give me a break. The hard truth is that Israel is doing our dirty work that we've failed to do. Does it come down to that's what it's going to take? That really all the international ceasefires and the international forces are really going to be ineffective?
No. I think that Israel wants an effective international force. But you see, there is also already a UN force in southern Lebanon.
Yes, but that's 1,200 UNIFIL observers as opposed to any kind of combat mission that they're supposed to have.
They take notes and report to Kofi Annan.
But this is the same Kofi Annan who, as head of UN peacekeeping, refused to allow the UN troops into Rwanda and refused to let General Dallaire do anything. And under 1559, they were authorized to send in up to 10,000 combat-ready troops, and he chose to send in only observers. So the point that's being made is that is any international force really going to have any effect, or can only sure. Israel do the job for the free world?
Sure. First of all, nobody in Israel believes that an international force should fight for Israel. Israel should do the job. All we want is that after we have rooted out the Hezbollah of this area, there will be an international force to oversee the weak Lebanese government army who will control the area. You know, until now, the Hezbollah refused to let the Lebanese government army. Actually, it was a state within a state. They didn't let the Lebanese army. Now, all of a sudden, when we are there,
the Lebanese leaders find verbal courage.
Hezbollah's leader Nasrallah today appeared in a televised speech, a recorded speech, in which he explained why now he agrees to let the Lebanese army come into the southern area. We know why he agrees, because the mainstay of this army, 60% of it, are Shiites. Many of them do support him. Now he wants them to come because he believes that this is a ploy that, with which he can force the UN to accept a resolution calling for Israel to withdraw, and then the Lebanese army will be there.
And he will strengthen his own position.
Yeah, exactly. And he will be either part of this army. And because, remember, the Hezbollah sits in the Lebanese government.
Government, they have two ministries.
They have two ministers there. So he believes to ride on the back of the Lebanese army, go back. He doesn't want an effective multinational or international force. You ask me, what is this force going to do? If it is going to be effective, it has to have a mandate to disarm any armed men who doesn't belong to the government.
And it's that mandate that we're going to be looking for to see what the UN can do. Ron Ben Ishai, thank you very much from Israel. Go get some sleep.
My pleasure.
Take care. Montreal will be right back. We're back and we're looking at the flashpoints in this frontline fight by Israel for Western freedom. And that's what it comes down to, bottom line. And perhaps one of the most scurrilous organizations that we have to deal with in this situation is the United Nations. One of the most hypocritical bodies, headed by a Secretary General, excuse me, who has overseen the refusal of the United Nations to act in Rwanda, who has overseen oil for food fraud where he protected his son, who has overseen commissions of the United Nations hopelessly biased against every free nation, but perhaps no bias greater than Israel's. Recently, the United Nations Human Rights Commission, as it was called, was reconstituted as a Human Rights Council, supposedly in order to give it some more legitimacy and to take out some of its more onerous members. Yet, of course, it's still controlled by a bunch of tin pot dictatorships, theocratic tyrannies, and one of the most eloquent statements about the UN and couldn't be applied better than to the UN Human Rights Council, is the following. The UN's discrimination against Israel is not a minor infraction, nor a parochial nuisance of interest solely to those concerned with equal rights of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. Instead, the world body's obsession with censuring Israel at every turn directly affects all citizens of the world, for it constitutes a severe violation of the equality principles guaranteed by the UN Charter and underlying the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and secondly, a significant obstacle to the UN's ability to carry out its proper mandate. None of this means Israel should be above the law. Every country, including every democracy, commits human rights violations, and states should be held to account accordingly, both domestically and internationally. Yet Israel does have the right to be treated equally under the law. The UN Charter and the rules of natural justice demand no less. It is legitimate for UN bodies to criticize Israel, but not when they do so unfairly, selectively, massively, sometimes exclusively, and always obsessively. And those are the words from United Nations Watch out of Geneva. And it's our privilege to have Hillel Neuer, the executive director of United Nations Watch, with us tonight. He's an ex-Montrealer who had a distinguished legal career in New York and now oversees this a variety of commissions attached to the United Nations. Hillel, thank you for taking the time to be with us. I know it's very late in Europe.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm a night owl, and it's an honor to be on your show.
How aggravating is it that and I want you to think about this and just answer me. We've got to pay some bills very quickly, but I want you to think on this. How aggravating is it to see and watch the council look at possible human rights violations by Israel when we've already found out that Khanna was not 60 dead, it was 25 dead, that the Israeli bombings of Khanna were 7.5 hours before the building collapsed, that Hezbollah is implanted within civilian populations and uses people as human shields, which is contrary to all doctrines of humanitarian law, and when we know that Hezbollah is not only doing hijacking civilians, but also UN personnel. And we'll be back with Hillel Neuer to discuss that question right after this. Montreal, we're back. Welcome to all the local listeners and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. It's our privilege to talk with Executive Director Hillel Neuer. Hillel is the Executive Director of United Nations Watch in Geneva, and we're going to be talking about the hypocrisy of the UN Human Rights Council discussing possible human rights violations by Israel. Hillel, I was asking before the break, how aggravating is it to listen to this hopeless hypocrisy that pours out of this council every day?
It's very difficult. It's really what comes to mind is George Orwell's the classic 1984, sitting in UN sessions. One hears things that remind one of war is peace and peace is war. The UN speak that one hears is virtually the opposite of every truth that we know. And it's terribly frustrating for anyone who cares about democracy and anyone who cares about human rights. And it's particularly frustrating, Beryl, because we're having this special session on Friday here in Geneva by the Human Rights Council. And we need to take a step back and remember in the past year what we were promised. And we were promised, and I mean by the European Union and even by major human rights organizations, that this council would mark a, quote, fresh start. Those were the words of the General Assembly.
That's
president,
right.
Replacing the discredited commission. Human Rights Watch said that it would be, quote, not business as usual. This would be something different. And yet here we are, this coming Friday, and we're three for three, by which I mean in the 2 months that the new council is in existence, it's the third session where 47 nations will meet, the members of the council, and they will solemnly assemble. They will condemn Israel, the Jewish state, to the exclusion of every one of the UN's other 191 countries.
And as importantly as the Jewish state, the only democratic state from the borders of Pakistan to the Moroccan Atlantic coast.
Indeed. And whether it's mass killing of blacks in Africa, or the jailing of journalists in Cuba, or the repression of women in Saudi Arabia, all of these things have been ignored in each of these sessions. And Israel is condemned, and then the members pat each other on the back and congratulate each other on a job well done.
And this is it's maddening even here in Canada. You know, we still have the case of Zahra Kazemi, the Montreal photojournalist, whose body can't be brought out of Iran. She was tortured to death. The guy who beat her over the head with a shoe was sent by Iran as the special observer to the UN Human Rights Council. And finally, we have a prime minister who stood up and actually asked for his arrest. And yet we just finished an administration where we had a prime minister who went and called Libya's Gaddafi a man with a philosophical bent of mind. Is there a possibility for any redemptive change?
It's very frustrating at this point, and it's very difficult to see any hope for meaningful change. As you've been mentioning, unfortunately, the United Nations as a whole is often dominated by alliances of repressive regimes, and what we're seeing at the Human Rights Council is almost 50% of the members are either outright repressive or fall short of basic democratic standards, while other countries that are democracies, and I mean countries like South Africa or some South American countries like Brazil, vote together with the non-democracies in what are very unholy alliances. And so you have a case where the General Assembly last year, they had a vote on Darfur for the victims of Darfur, and a majority voted no action
on
Darfur.
And I want to make it clear to our listeners, and you can go into more detail on this. United Nations Watch is not there to oppose the United Nations. It wants the United Nations to uphold its principles for everyone. And as president of the Institute for Public Affairs over the past 2 years until the Harper government, we led demonstrations to call on the liberal government to call Darfur a genocide. It refused to do that until this government was elected. Democracies who refuse to call it as it is, it's something that's staggering to the imagination that over the past 60 years and a century of blood, they haven't learned.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, when we go back to the United Nations founding, I think every true Democrat supports the noble principles of the United Nations, which is to end the scourge of war and to promote human rights. And in fact, in its early years, the United Nations did some great things, and over the years there have been successes. But what we've seen in recent years is the rise of repressive regimes and the strength that they have and the shamelessness with which they've taken over key bodies, including, unfortunately, the Human Rights Council. And so we were promised change, and right now, as I said, we're 3 for 3. It's the third session since it was founded 2 months ago. At each session, they have met and condemned only Israel, not a single other country in the world. Whether it's 4 million killed in Congo since 1998, it's been utterly ignored.
Well, let's give our listeners a taste of some of the great constitutional liberalisms that are represented on the Human Rights Council. What are some of the more glaring examples of members who shouldn't be there?
Well, I mean, the ones that come to mind, and there's a long list of the 47 members, but one comes to mind is Saudi Arabia, a country where women can not only not vote, they can't drive a car, there's no religious freedom. Whether you're Christian or Jew, you can't practice your religion. There's preaching of hatred against all non-Muslim infidels. That is one of the members of the Human Rights Council, which judges others and, in fact, has spoken out as a representative of the entire Asian bloc at the Human Rights Council. We have China, where there's over 1 billion people who don't have any basic freedom, whether it's freedom of religion. The Falun Gong and others have been persecuted and tortured, whether it's freedom
of
assembly.
Their organs are harvested.
I mean, it's an outrage. And
by the Chinese own numbers, they killed 20,000 political prisoners last year.
And the list goes on. You have Algeria, where thousands have been killed, in Pakistan, Cuba.
And yet Israel becomes a moral resort area for them. Israel, where Arabs and Arab Muslims are diplomats, parliamentarians, judges. That's a moral resort area for the tyrants of the world. Yet Jews can't get visas to most Arab countries.
Well, all this is quite true. And indeed, if we look at what's happening this week, I think we're seeing so much more of the same, and yet there's something new. And if I could, I'd like to walk our listeners to do something.
Hillel, could you just hold the thought? Would you
sure.
Go to pay a bill? We'll be right back.
Sure.
And see what you can expect from this meeting. Or email us at info@iapm.ca. We're talking to Hillel Neuer, Executive Director of United Nations Watch in Geneva. And Hillel, you were about to tell us before the break what you're hoping, what the best case scenario could be, what kind of reforms can be made to this Human Rights Council.
Well, unfortunately, it's a very pessimistic situation. The fact is that if you have rotten ingredients, you're going to get a rotten soup. And what we have is virtually 50% of the Human Rights Council are countries that are either repressive regimes or just fail to meet basic democratic standards. They're very powerful. They dominate the largest regional alliances, the African group, the Asian group. They're dominated by the Islamic countries, countries like China and Cuba. Communist tyrannies, the result is just very bad for human rights. You know, whatever we try to do in the last session, and I mean NGOs that care about democracy like UN Watch, and some of the Western democracies, try to pass certain things in the recent session, and the best they could get was 12 out of 47 votes, so they kept losing. The best you could get was Japan, Canada, EU and affiliated countries when they stood up for freedom of speech, for example, on the Danish cartoons issue and so many other things. The best they could get was 12 out of 47 seats. So that's the reality, and we're going to continue struggling to make the best of this council because we have no other choice, but I think we have to be very realistic, and I'm concerned that too many groups have been whitewashing its deficiencies and its defects in order to present it as a butterfly when in fact it's still a caterpillar.
But you know what? As long as there are groups like yours, and as long as there are advocates like you, it's also our job here in the free world to help those leaders that understand that. And we've been encouraging people on this program to express their support for Prime Minister Harper's positions on the Middle East crisis, but also on his support for democracies in general. And between people like you giving out the information and having your voice heard, and with populations that can be stimulated to get active, to write, to support Western leaders, that fight has to be kept up.
Well, it is, and I think your show is doing a marvelous job, and I'll encourage our listeners that, you know, every voice counts, believe it or not. On our website, which is www.unwatch.org, listeners can click and send a message to Kofi Annan about what the UN ought to do for democracy and what the UN ought to be doing for true peace in the Middle East and enforce its own resolutions. So the truth is everyone can and should do something, whether it's contacting their own member of parliament and prime minister. And we're certainly encouraged that Prime Minister Harper has been taking a very strong moral stand about the differences between democracy and terror organization, and has been unafraid to state the basic truth that until now we've seen, you know, a country that we have a lot to do with and we have many similarities, which is Australia, which has taken the lead on things. And Canada votes with Australia in many areas, but in other things was shying away, and we're seeing Prime Minister Harper joining that sort of willingness to speak out firmly in support of universal values.
You've raised a very important point that we underline to our listeners all the time. A politician, when they or when I say politician, I don't just mean an elected politician. Any public official, when they get one letter, they think that it stands for 100 people. And what Hill Noyer is saying is true. Write. If you believe, then at least write. If you can't march, write. If you can't participate, write. They will listen to it and support the work of UN Watch. And you can look at their work at unwatch.org. Hill Noyer from Geneva, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
From Tel Aviv to Geneva, and now from Geneva to the West Coast in California, Victor Davis Hanson is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and the author of A War Like No Other. He's one of the most important repositories of reason in the current debate about where the West should stand. And I just want to read to you a very small piece of a column that he wrote that appeared in the National Review and that appeared across the country today in the National Post. He said, when I used to read about the 1930s, the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, the rise of fascism, the appeasement in France and Britain, I never could quite figure out why, during those bleak years, Europeans and those in America didn't speak out and condemn the growing madness. It's still surreal to reread the fantasies of Chamberlain and Daladier and even Pope Pius. But, he concludes, not any longer. Our present generation, too, is on the brink of moral insanity. And this has never been more evident than in the last 4 weeks, as the West has proven utterly unable to distinguish between an attacked democracy that seeks to strike back at terrorist combatants and terrorist aggressors who seek to kill civilians. Victor Davis Hanson, well, it's a privilege to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me here.
How bad is it?
I'm very worried.
Compared to other periods, the 50s, the Cold War, when people were talking about the West being lethargic and apathetic, have we gone from that to straight out appeasement?
I think so. I think that after World War II, the galvanization of Westerners against communism was between 1945 and 47. By 48, everybody knew what the Soviet Union was about and the fellow travelers and the people in the State Department. This is different, though. I mean, almost every day we see people attacked in Seattle, and nobody seems to care. We've had this Al-Qaedaism, whether it's at the L.A. airport, or whether it's somebody in a suburb of Maryland, we don't seem to think it's something to worry about. We see doctored photos. We see inaccurate reports. We all know now that the major news services can't be trusted to deliver the news in a professional and unbiased way. The main thing is, though, if you ask the average American, did you know there's a million Israelis in shelters, or do you realize that every rocket that's sent into Israel is by intent and design aimed at a civilian, and that's not true of the Israeli precision weapons. They don't understand that. They don't understand in this age of moral equivalence and a therapeutic society. They don't understand the difference. So I feel sometimes like a few of us are writing or speaking to a deaf and dumb audience. It seems the West in large, and Europe is gone.
Victor Davis Hanson. Hold that thought. We just have to pay some bills. I want to come back and ask you about the media, particularly, and what we've learned in the past week and how the reaction has been to that. We'll be right back. The spirit of appeasement abroad in the world. Our special guest is Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of A War Like No Other. Victor, you were talking earlier about the media and the things we've seen come out of the Middle East with less of a reaction than there should be. You know, with the past 10 days, we've had CNN senior international correspondent Nick Robertson say there were stories that were faked out of Beirut because the reporters were scared because Hezbollah had copies of their passports. We've had people like Ben Wiedemann, another CNN correspondent, say, hey, Khana wasn't 60 people and there was no blood there. This disinformation campaign, is that contributing to this? Is that confusing the
Absolutely.
Public?
Absolutely. I have great sympathy for the Israelis because we all get exasperated and say, you know, where's your public relations campaign because you're losing the narrative. But on the other hand, realize that journalists, by definition, come out of an academic environment. They're very critical, cynical, sarcastic about Western culture in general, as a rule. And then specifically in the Middle East, they know that if they portray Israelis negatively, an Israeli is going to come over and give them donuts and coffee and give them a lecture. If they do that with Hezbollah or Hamas, they're going to be killed. And if they're going
to choice.
Be... Exactly. And human nature being human nature, not everybody's always and at every location courageous. And then they hire stringers as well. In Israel, you don't need a stringer because you can go anywhere and you can talk to people and discuss and argue with them and find people who agree or disagree with you. You go into Lebanon and you're in southern Lebanon, you hire somebody to go get the story and then you can say that it's authentic, but you don't have to go do that yourself because it's dangerous.
What can turn the West? You're a scholar of history. You're a scholar of Greek and Roman history. Is it going to take a Churchill who took the English language and marshaled it and brought it out to war? What can turn?
Now, I wish it could. I wish that Churchill could, but remember, Churchill could not galvanize Britain in 35, 36, 36.
No.
What galvanized Britain was the invasion into Poland in 39 after Hitler had sworn he wouldn't do it, and that did not galvanize the United States. Only Pearl Harbor did. Well, only thing will galvanize the United States, and this is a cliche because you've heard this line, is another 9/11, because we thought that the worst damage on our home soil in the history of the United States would do it, but apparently it's been almost 5 years and people have forgotten.
In rereading a book recently on the period, the pre-generalized war period, I came across the incident of when the Soviet Union asked Poland for permission to send an army across its territory to stop Hitler at the Sudetenland, and the Poles refused and Russia didn't go. And all the arguments every time America has to have landing rights to refuel its planes, it brings back these images that in 70 years of blood, the world learned nothing.
Well, we see the same situation today. The United States has been denied use of its facilities almost everywhere when it's a question of supplying Israel. Remember in the Cold War, our allies that were in the NATO alliance, like Greece, would not let the United States land to supply Israel, but let the Soviet Union go with their airspace to supply the enemies of the United States. So it's not new, but in this particular period that we live in, because of this new age of terror, I think that's another thing that people need to understand, that the terror that we see today is different than 5 years ago. Hezbollah has more sophisticated weapons almost than Israel does. They can get it off the shop. They have night vision goggles. They have sophisticated communications. They have sophisticated anti-tank weapons. We're dealing with $500 billion in petrol windfall profits, not profits, windfall profits in the last 24 months when that price went to $22, from $22 to nearly $80. And that money is circulating in the Middle East, and it ends up in the hands of people like Hezbollah, they have a minister of information that has an email address and business cards. This is a very sophisticated, hardcore terrorist enemy that has more money than they know what to do with, and they understand that the West will either sell them anything they need or will appease them.
And one hopes that the West will be galvanized to understand that it's better to take the war to them over there than bring it here. Victor Davis Hanson, I'm terribly sorry, but we're out of time. I thank you for joining us, and if you permit me, we're going to have you on again. Because this issue ain't going away anytime soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Montreal, that's it for tonight. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Chris Smith, thanks a lot.